If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
Highland, Sacramento.
Use the word affordability. It's a Democrat hoax. They're the ones that drove the prices up.
President Trump swings into the swing state of Pennsylvania today to address the economic anxieties of Americans.
For Tuesday, December 9th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. President Trump's tariffs have hit American farmers hard.
We'll hear their reaction to the president's offer to help this week.
It's meaningful. I'm not going to say it's not meaningful, but is the quantity going to alleviate all the farmers' concerns? I don't think so.
Also, teenagers in Boulder, Colorado are learning how to help build affordable houses.
It's not like we're building a little mini project. It's real world type stuff.
And scholars set out to make the world's first dictionary of ancient Celtic words. I might even try to pronounce some.
Those stories and more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. The Trump administration is stepping up efforts to curb illegal immigration in the U.S., but extremism experts say the administration is using language that comes directly from the white nationalist movement. NPR's Odette Youssef reports.
After an Afghan national was arrested in the shooting of two National Guard members in the nation's capital, Trump called for reverse migration. The State Department and the Department of Homeland Security have also used the term remigration in social media and planning documents. Heidi Byrick of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism says European white nationalists use remigration to refer to the ethnic cleansing of non-white people.
When I think about this, I cannot believe that a federal government in the United States would use terms that come from white supremacists. There's always been some sort of barrier to that being mainstreamed.
The White House, State Department, and DHS rejected or did not acknowledge questions about the term's link to an extremist movement. Odette Youssef, NPR News.
President Trump is touting his tariff policies and airing old grievances during a rally in Pennsylvania. Polls show voter confidence in Trump's economic leadership has faltered, but Trump blames former President Joe Biden for the country's economic woes.
I have no higher priority than making America affordable again. That's what we're going to do. And again, they caused the high prices, and we're bringing them down. It's a simple message.
The event is in Monroe County, which flipped Trump's way in 2024, helping him win the swing state and return to office. Farmers say they're encouraged by President Trump's $12 billion aid package meant to help them get by during his trade war with China. But as NPR's Kirk Siegler reports, it's not clear the one-time windfall will be enough to prevent many farm bankruptcies and foreclosures.
These bridge payments, as the president is calling them, should be coming to farmers early next year. Many, like Kevin Deinert, are on thin margins due to inflation, tariffs, and Trump's trade war closing off Asian markets for soybeans. Most here in the Dakotas are grown for export.
And, you know, as farmers, we want trade, not aid. Bridge payments is going to kind of maybe help pay for inputs as we go into the next year.
Pretty much all of Deinert's soybeans are still sitting in storage. He's holding out for higher prices and is counting on the administration's promises that it's secured deals with China so that country begins importing commodities from the U.S. again. Kirk Siegler, NPR News, Mitchell, South Dakota.
Conservative Supreme Court justices appear supportive of a Republican-led drive to erase limits on how much political parties can spend in coordination with candidates for Congress and president. Such a ruling would overturn a quarter-century-old decision. The Republican committees for House and Senate candidates filed the lawsuit in Ohio in 2022. Democrats are calling on the court to uphold the spending caps. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. New legislation announced in San Francisco today would prohibit federal agencies from using city properties for immigration enforcement. KQED's Sydney Johnson has more.
Supervisor Bilal Mahmoud's proposal would block federal law enforcement from using city-owned buildings, parks, and even parking lots for anything that could disrupt public services. Mahmoud says aggressive immigration enforcement across the country has driven many undocumented residents into hiding.
Families stay away from school, seniors miss medical appointments, businesses close or reduce their hours, and workers miss shifts, all of which contribute to lost revenue, local economic decline, and a reduction in public safety.
The legislation would allow the city attorney to take legal action for unauthorized use of city property. It heads to the full Board of Supervisors in January. I'm Sydney Johnson, KQED News.
More than a week after a mass shooting at a child's birthday party in Stockton, authorities say they're looking for multiple suspects, but haven't made any arrests. San Joaquin Sheriff Patrick Withrow says more than 50 shots were fired at the scene and at least 5 guns were used.
I'm asking the public to be patient. I know this is going to be difficult, but this is not going to be in a week or two. We've got an answer and we start arresting people. You have to know that. Okay, this is going to take months.
The sheriff told the San Joaquin County Board of Supervisors this morning that the initial scene was so chaotic, deputies were initially sent to the wrong location. 3 children and a 21-year-old were killed in the November 29th shooting. 13 others were injured. I'm Natalia Navarro, KQED News.
Support comes from San Francisco Bay University with degrees in tech and business for an AI-driven economy, sfbu.edu. Support for NPR comes from the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future, and from the listeners of KQED. And support for KQED comes from Postman. Used by over 40 million developers and 98% of the Fortune 500, Postman offers a platform where teams build APIs that help AI agents and humans make smarter decisions. More at postman.com.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. Life has gotten very expensive for Americans. Food prices, utility bills, healthcare costs. So it is no surprise that affordability is becoming a campaign centerpiece for Democrats and Republicans as we start looking ahead to next year's midterms. President Trump is in the most important swing state in the country, Pennsylvania, today, to try to take those issues head on. But this is a topic that in recent weeks, the president has struggled to address.
Use the word affordability. It's a Democrat hoax. They're the ones that drove the prices up.
Trump is in Monroe County, a place in northeastern Pennsylvania that backed President Biden in 2020, then swung to Trump in the 2024 election. So how are swing voters in a swing state feeling about all of this? Called up Christopher Bork, professor of political science at Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and the director of the college's Institute of Public Opinion. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Scott.
You are the person to call when we want to know about public opinion in Pennsylvania. So let's start with kind of the basic numbers that you are seeing. How are Pennsylvanians feeling about the economy? How are they feeling about President Trump?
Yeah, not surprisingly, Scott, they mirror lots of what we see nationally. Pennsylvanians are not in a good mood regarding the economy, the direction of the nation as a whole. And that's reflected in their appraisals of President Trump. His job approval numbers are in the low 40s, which again mirror what's happening nationally. It's not the same environment that he found just a year ago in the Commonwealth when he was able to carry the state for the second out of 3 attempts here.
In terms of the numbers you're seeing, approval ratings, things like that, how much has changed or how little has changed over the past 12 months?
Well, as you know very well, Pennsylvania is a state that's always on the margin when it comes to presidential elections, and often just the smallest changes are really impactful. And so last year when the president carried Pennsylvania, he did so by, you know, a little over a point, almost 2 points. And therefore, his margin of error, if you will, in terms of staying above water, isn't that great. Mm-hmm. And so if you lose even 5 to 10% of the voters in the state, it's significant. And if you look at where his polls are now compared to where they were a year ago, there has been loss. And most of that loss is in terms of his handling of areas that were once a strength.
Yeah.
And those strengths are economic matters, where he's seen the biggest decline in terms of how the public views him.
He, just like Joe Biden before him, would blame the economy on Donald Trump. Trump is regularly blaming the economy on Joe Biden. We are a year into this administration. Do you have any sense from what you're seeing and hearing of the limits of that kind of message?
I think it's very limited, Scott, the ability to really convince people a year in almost to his administration that this is largely the impact of the cards that he was dealt when he came into office. I think the president's got a really difficult time making that case. It's going up against what people feel and Pennsylvanians feel. And right now they don't feel good. They don't feel good about lots of things. They don't feel good about electricity prices. They don't feel good about housing prices in the area. They certainly don't feel good about healthcare. And while the president can craft a message that targets the Biden era impacts, I think it's not necessarily reaching the audience in a way that's mattering for him.
You know, it's such a static political country. You talk about the fact that Pennsylvania is always on the margins, but it's a state that went for Trump, went against Trump, went for Trump again. What is the best way to think about the voters who have gone back and forth, and what draws their attention, what turns them off, what wins their support?
Yeah, Scott, it's a group that I think is longing for something and not always easily defined. As you said, they've vacillated now in Pennsylvania and places like Monroe County, Northampton County, the eastern side of the state, over the last three elections. And I think they're searching for something that's not necessarily always easily attainable. Mm-hmm. And right now, who's ever in power seems to be paying a price for that longing. It's hard to make a case, right? It's hard to make a case to voters who aren't happy that you are really doing a good job. Biden struggled, Trump struggled before him, and now Trump is struggling again. It's a big challenge to convince unhappy voters that you're doing a job that's, you know, serving their best interest.
That's Christopher Borick, professor of political science at Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania, also the director of the college's Institute of Public Opinion. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks, Scott.
Affordable housing and a shortage of skilled workers are big challenges across the country. A school district in Boulder, Colorado, has formed a partnership with the city and Habitat for Humanity to teach kids trades by building homes that working people can afford. Sam Fuqua reports.
We're inside a 32,000 square foot factory where modular homes are in various stages of construction. High school teacher Darren Rasmussen and student June Baker huddle over blueprints, figuring out what went wrong with the drywall installation.
When he said it was way too small, wall A.
It was like 5 or 10.
We have one wall A that's right and then one that's not built because I had to take it apart. But I've learned my mistake, and then they realized from that mistake that they need to start labeling each wall with numbers.
Bye. Ready up there?
The city of Boulder built this $13 million factory on land owned by the Boulder Valley School District, with help from state, federal, and private foundation grants and loans. And it pays for the materials used to build the houses. Students get hands-on experience building homes and course credit. The local Habitat for Humanity chapter manages the program. All the groups involved say the three-way partnership is the first of its kind in the nation. In November, they trucked their first two homes a few miles away to the Ponderosa Mobile Home Park, where they were hoisted by crane onto foundations. High school senior Sean McCormick was helping out.
I think it was a big accomplishment for us and what we can do in the future and all the problem solving we had to do. And because it's not like we're building a little mini project. It's real world type stuff.
McCormick plans to go to trade school to become an electrician or pipe fitter. The industry group American Institute of Constructors estimates the U.S. will need more than 500,000 workers to keep up with demand. After this mobile home park flooded, the city bought it, fixed problems, and began working with Habitat for Humanity on upgrading the housing. Dan McCauley is CEO of Flatirons Habitat for Humanity.
So the families who are getting houses here have been living in substandard housing, some of them for decades.
Residents have the option of staying in their mobile home or buying one of these new modular houses.
All of these families will have a mortgage. The mortgage is based on their ability to pay and their income, so there is a significant subsidy involved.
The three-bed, two-bath homes are 1,150 square feet. McCauley estimates costs will range between $350,000 and $450,000. The median price of a single-family home in Boulder last year was over $1.3 million. Maribel Gonzalez-Rodriguez is one of the new homeowners. She lives in a small, older mobile home just steps away from her new house. She'll move into it soon.
Me siento muy emocionada porque
Nos están dando la oportunidad de tener nuestra propia casa en nuestro mismo lugar de...
She says it's incredibly exciting that she gets to have her own house. Her trailer right now is 2 bedrooms and there's not a lot of space. She's a single mom with 4 kids. They share the bedrooms. Maribel sleeps on the couch. She's lived in Boulder almost 25 years and works in the kitchen of a downtown hotel.
Y lo que me gusta es que no me voy a mover de Boulder y tengo el área más, la vista más bonita de...
She'll have her own upstairs bedroom with, she says, the prettiest view in Boulder. For NPR News, I'm Sam Fuqua.
Our next story has big golden retriever energy, and by that I mean 2,397 golden retrievers, and they're humans, converging at a park in Buenos Aires, Argentina on Monday morning to set a new unofficial world record for the most golden retrievers in one spot.
That's right. The idea came from a 10-year-old golden named Ollie. Or more precisely, the idea came from a 28-year-old man named Fausto Dupare. That's him hyping the event on social media. Dupare is an actor, a cafe owner, and a self-described pet-friendly content creator. He and his friend Flavia Fittipaldi have coordinated other gatherings of dogs before, but this one was, of course, way bigger.
A few years ago, Dupare went to an event in Barcelona in Spain that gathered 150 goldens. He and Fittipaldi decided to look up where else this had happened.
Vancouver held, in the past, the largest amount of golden retrievers gathered in one event. It was around 1,600.
She says when they talked to the Argentine government about trying to permit a world record attempt, officials were all about it.
They said that as long as we left everything in perfect conditions, there was nothing to be done. It was just go and enjoy.
Now, gathering thousands of families and their pepperonis from across the country meant finding pet-friendly places for them to stay overnight. That was another big task to coordinate.
People volunteer like, I have a house, come with your dogs, how many are you, stay with me. So that was really nice.
Fittipaldi says there's something special about golden retrievers, that they're iconic for a reason.
They are just big dogs and hairy, but they are eternal kids. That's what you sense from them. They just want to play all the time. They are happy, upbeat. They like getting into pools and swimming with golden retrievers. It's just beautiful to see.
The AP reported you could hear these 2,000-plus dogs barking from miles away.
And from the looks of the photos, everybody was such a good doggy. But we all know photos sometimes lie.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Your KQED traffic update at 5:18 starts with trouble in Discovery Bay. Here's Julie Deppish.
Hey, we're looking at Highway 4 heading eastbound before Western Farms Ranch Road. That's a 2-vehicle wreck, been blocking the middle lane, causing that delay back to Discovery Bay Boulevard. Big trouble Santa Rosa, 4-vehicle pileup on North 101 and Highway 12. They're on the shoulder now to crawl, though, from Roner Park Expressway. And a couple vehicles colliding in San Jose, South 280 before Meridian Avenue. Everything on the right shoulder. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Julie will have another update in 10 minutes. Support for KQED comes from San Francisco International Airport. This holiday season, drivers are picking up or dropping off loved ones using the Kiss and Fly area to avoid congestion at the terminals, making spirits even brighter. FlySFO.com/kissandfly. And from Siouan's The Christmas Ballet, this joyful production features both classical ballet and contemporary numbers, with new additions premiering alongside audience favorites. Now through December 28th, tickets at SiouanBallet.org. Scientists are using artificial intelligence to make smart bionic limbs, and details are ahead in the next segment of All Things Considered.
We get it.
AI bots and algorithms are overfeeding you with too many options. Why not enjoy human recommendations from the experienced critics on the KQED Arts and Culture team? At the end of this year, we're looking back on the best of 2025. The best art exhibits, plays, and albums from the Bay Area. The movies that set our hearts on fire, and the tastiest restaurant dishes. You can find it all at kqed.org/arts.
Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay in theaters this Friday. And from Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. And from the listeners of KQED San Francisco, KQEI North Highland Sacramento, and live online at kqed.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. There are more than 500,000 words in the Oxford English Dictionary. Some trace their origin as far back as the 11th century. For centuries, linguists and academics have kept careful track of those words and their origins, but not every language gets cataloged in the same way. Take, for example, ancient Celtic. Those are early languages used by the peoples of the British Isles thousands of years ago, and some of those words can be found in modern Irish and Welsh. Simon Rodway is a professor at Aberystwyth University on the west coast of Wales. He's trying to put together the surviving pieces of this language. He and his colleague recently set out to make the world's first dictionary of ancient Celtic words. Welcome, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, my goodness. Thanks for being with us. Okay, so as we said, there are about 500,000 words in the Oxford English Dictionary. How many words are in the dictionary that you are making?
Well, we're still at an early stage, but I mean, I'd say we've probably got over 1,000, but we're not going to get many more than that because the records of the Celtic languages in Britain and Ireland are not great.
You say about 1,000 words of ancient Celtic, but is that like a very small proportion of what you suspect is the total amount of words that were used in history?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's just a tiny little glimpse into the language. I mean, we're particularly looking at the ancient Celtic languages spoken in Britain and Ireland. Of course, they were spoken on the continent of Europe as well, over a great swathe of the continent of Europe, in fact. That kind of helps us because we can see similarities and differences. And in the Roman period, when most of Britain is part of the Roman Empire, the Romans were very literate. They wrote everything down. They were hugely bureaucratic. So we have a lot of letters. We've got legal stuff. We've got
Yeah, thank God for bureaucracy sometimes.
Yeah, quite. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, they were using Latin, which is the official language of the Roman Empire. But they were recording place names, they were recording people's names, they were recording some words which had obviously got into Latin.
And can you talk about these texts a little more, these texts that are primarily in Latin, but where you find the occasional ancient Celtic word embedded in it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we've got quite a few of these, mostly written in Latin, but they've got Celtic names and so on. And what's really interesting, really exciting, is we've got a very small number. We're literally talking about 4 or 5 texts that are written entirely in Celtic. And most of these are curse tablets.
Curse tablets?
That's
ancient
right.
Ancient Celtic curse tablets.
That's right. Ancient Celtic curse tablets.
What are these curses about?
Well, I mean, mostly they're curses against thieves who have stolen the belongings of people, particularly in Bath. In Bath, you've got some Roman baths. They're incredible. And people used to go there and bathe in the waters, which are naturally hot. So quite often, because it was kind of like a tourist attraction, there were thieves there. So people would take off the clothes and they get in the bath and they come out and they find that somebody had stolen their clothes.
I see.
What they do then is they would find somebody who had a sheet of lead and they'd scratch a curse on that lead tablet, asking a god or a goddess to do all sorts of horrible things to the person who'd taken their belongings, and they throw that into the spring, which was consecrated to the goddess.
Okay, so Simon, how do I say goodbye to you in ancient Celtic?
Goodbye. Well, I mean, we could perhaps hypothesize that ancient Briton, speaking of the ancestor of Welsh, might say something like, in Welsh, one of the ways we say goodbye is yn iach.
Yn iach.
Yn iach.
Okay. Simon Rodway at Aberystwyth University. Anyach. It was lovely to talk to you.
Anyach. Thank you. And you too.
Scientists are using artificial intelligence to help bionic limbs act more like natural ones. And here's John Hamilton reports on an experimental hand that shares control with the user to carry out tricky tasks like holding up a styrofoam coffee cup.
The latest bionic hands can swivel, move individual fingers, and manipulate objects. They can also detect electrical signals coming from the muscles that used to control those actions. But Marshall Trout, a researcher at the University of Utah, says most prosthetic hands still aren't very smart.
The person has to sit there and really focus on what they're doing. They have to maintain like line of sight with whatever it is they're trying to handle, which is really not at all how a intact hand behaves.
Which is one reason that many people who get a fancy prosthetic hand stop using it. So Trout and a team of scientists set out to make a smarter prosthetic that would act more like a person's own hand.
I just know where my coffee cup is and I can reach without having to pay too much attention. And as my hand gets closer, I can kind of feel where it is and my hand will just naturally squeeze and make contact with it. And that's kind of what we wanted to try to recreate with the system.
The team turned to artificial intelligence to take on some of these subconscious functions. This meant detecting not just the signal coming from a muscle, but the intention behind it. For example, Trout says the AI control system learned to detect the tiniest twitch in a muscle that flexes the hand.
The moment we detect that small amount of flexion, that's when the machine controller kicks on, saying, oh, I'm trying to grasp something. I'm not just sitting still.
To make the approach work, the scientists modified a bionic hand by adding sensors that see and feel. That allowed the AI system to gauge the distance to an object and assess its shape. Meanwhile, pressure sensors on the fingertips told the user how firmly their prosthetic hand was holding the object. To test the system, Trout's team asked four people missing a natural hand to use the bionic version to drink from a cup, with and without help from AI.
With machine assistance, they could very reliably pick up these cups and mime drinking a sip of water out of the cup. And then without the machine assistance, the person just crushed it or dropped it every single time.
The results appear in the journal Nature Communications. And Jacob George, who oversaw the research at the Utah Neurorobotics Lab, says they address a problem that people often encounter when they use superhuman technology.
You can make a robotic hand that can do tasks better than a human user. But when you actually give that to someone, they don't like it. You know, they actually hate this.
Because they feel like it's not a part of them and it's out of their control. George says this artificial intelligence system shares control with the user.
The machine is doing something and the human is doing something and we're combining those two together.
George says that's a critical step toward prosthetic limbs that feel like an extension of the person's own body.
Ultimately, when you create an embodied robotic hand, it becomes a part of that user's experience. It becomes a part of themselves and not just a tool.
One reason we feel that way about our own hands is that they're controlled in part by reflexes in the brainstem and spinal cord. John Downey of the University of Chicago, who was not involved in the study, says that means the thinking part of our brain doesn't have to worry about the details of every motion.
All of our motor control involves reflexes that are subconscious. And so providing robotic imitations of those reflex loops is going to be important.
But Downey says sometimes a human brain is needed to do things artificial intelligence still can't.
We can very finely manipulate things like putting a thread through needle and things like that, which take almost no force at all the way up to, you know, grabbing a child and lifting them. The dynamic range on that is far beyond what robots typically handle.
For now, anyway. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
KQED News with Natalia Navarro is coming up after your KQED traffic update starting in San Jose. Here's Julie Deppish.
A new problem on southbound 880 after the 101 interchange. Left lane is blocked. A three-vehicle collision there, backing things up to Great Mall Parkway. Got another San Jose crash on northbound 280 just before Guadalupe Parkway. All that on the right shoulder now. Coming into San Francisco, upper deck of the Bay Bridge, they've just turned the metering lights on. It's the usual brake lights between the island and 101. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Traffic support comes comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa at Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Frontline PBS, presenting 2,000 Meters to Andriivka, a documentary about Ukrainian soldiers fighting for every inch of their land in the Russia-Ukraine war, now streaming on PBS.org and the PBS app. Awards eligible. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers, announcing the Season of New Traditions event going on now at local Kia dealers, offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More info at kia.com. It's 5:30.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. President Donald Trump remains unpopular in California. That's according to a new poll, which also shows former Representative Katie Porter leading the field in the 2026 governor's race. KQED politics correspondent Marisa Lagos reports.
The poll from the Public Policy Institute of California found Porter, a Democrat, with 21% support among likely voters. But it was taken last month before more Democrats entered the race. Mark Baldessari is a survey director for PPIC.
Obviously, it's a wide open race, and many people say that they're currently not satisfied with the choices that they had. So we'll see how people feel now that there are more choices.
Baldessari says the poll also shows Trump with the lowest approval rating since his term started nearly a year ago, and widespread disapproval of his signature policies, including immigration enforcement and the deployment of troops to American cities. I'm Marisa Lagos, KQED News.
Conservationists have found coho salmon in a creek on the Sonoma coast for the first time in 60 years. Press Democrat reporter Amy Windsor says Wildlands Conservancy biologists were shocked to find juveniles of the endangered fish swimming in the eastern branch of the Russian Gulch. Windsor says that's likely due to a few wet winters and conservation efforts in the area.
They removed stumps that were 15 feet high from these stream beds. They cleared the sediment and made a 3.5 mile long channel. You know, there were decades of logging, including industrial scale operations. The gravel beds that salmon need for spawning were completely buried.
Windsor says that's a good sign, but still a fraction of the historical numbers of coho. A major BART expansion is underway in Santa Clara County, where crews are preparing to dig a massive tunnel underneath San Jose. KQED's Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman visited the construction site yesterday.
Just blocks away from San Jose Mineta International Airport is a site the VTA is calling the West Portal.
Follow those folks for me, please. I appreciate it. Watch your footing.
This dirt lot is about a mile long, and it's full of cranes, trucks, and crews. All the work right now is focused on preparing a steep concrete ramp for the arrival of a tunnel boring machine. Sarah Wilson is the construction director for BART Silicon Valley Phase 2.
It's really cool. It's huge. It's state-of-the-art. Like, it's going to be so much fun.
The project will add 6 new miles of BART track, 4 new stations, and connect with the existing BART system at Berryessa Station. Most of that track will be located under San Jose.
We can see progress, and we have momentum, and we need to keep that momentum going.
Tom McGuire is with the VTA, which is building the expansion. The project was originally slated to finish by next year at a cost of $4.7 billion. But it's faced heavy delays and cost overruns. It's now expected to cost nearly 3 times that and take more than 10 years longer. Sudhanshu Jain is a Santa Clara City Council member and a member of the BART Oversight Committee for this project.
Oh, it's transformational because, you know, we are already have massive traffic congestion.
When it's completed, the expansion will connect with Caltrain in Santa Clara, creating a ring of electrified rail transit around the San Francisco Bay. I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman, KQED News.
And I'm Natalia Navarro.
Support comes from Oakland San Francisco Bay Airport. Beauty, pride, love. Learn more at iFlyOAK.com. Support for KQED comes from Netflix, presenting The Perfect Neighbor, a documentary by Geeta Gandabir. Body cam footage bears witness to a tight-knit community navigating one neighbor's relentless harassment and the consequences of Florida's stand-your-ground laws. Awards eligible. And from the Watermark at San Jose, a senior living community providing assisted living and memory care with amenities like on-site restaurants, a fitness center and spa, and salon services. Learn more at sanjosewatermark.com. And this week at KQED.org, we meet two Bay Area teenagers who are mapping the movements of coyotes in Silicon Valley, plus how to understand your options for paying back student loans. That's at KQED.org. Support for NPR comes from Heifer International, where people can donate animal gifts like goats, chickens, or sheep to struggling families to help them create sustainable futures. Learn more at heifer.org/NPR. From the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action. And from the listeners of KQED-FM 88.5 San Francisco and KQEI-FM 89.3 North Highland Sacramento and live online at kqed.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump says that he is sending $12 billion in aid to American farmers who are reeling from global trade disruptions. Disruptions like inflation and Trump's tariffs, which are making fertilizer and farm equipment more expensive. Also, the president's trade war with China closed a huge market for American soybean exports. We're going to get the view now from the Midwest, and to do that, we're going to bring in NPR's Kirk Sigler, who's joining us from Mitchell, South Dakota. Hi, Kirk.
Hey, Elsa.
Hey. Okay, so tell us a little bit about where you are right now and why that's such a good starting point for this whole story.
Well, I'm in the heart of row crop country. Think of soybeans, think of corn. Of course, I'm looking out the window right now. It's all covered in snow, bracing for another lot of wind and more blizzard-like conditions possibly tonight. But I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you that Mitchell is home to the world's only corn palace.
Huh.
You could picture, like a classic Midwest roadside attraction. But I mention this because it's symbolic of how farming literally touches every part of life and the economy here. And right now, I have to tell you, the mood continues to be one of anxiety.
Yeah, I imagine so. And just yesterday, the White House said that this $12 billion aid package for farmers is supposed to bridge the gap between President Biden's failures, that's how President Trump put it, and his successful policies, Trump's successful policies. So let me ask you, Kirk, is that how farmers are seeing it?
Well, that depends on who you ask. Conservative groups like the Farm Bureau are calling it an encouraging sign. Farmer unions, even here in red Trump states like South Dakota, say this bailout, as they say, was all preventable if President Trump hadn't started another trade war with China like he did in his first term. You know, this has led to China levying retaliatory tariffs, buying soybeans from Brazil instead, and longstanding export markets have really been closed to American farmers. So this $12 billion deal we're talking about isn't even as big as the 2019 aid package was, but generally, Elsa, I'd say farmers are relieved to see some money coming finally because, you know, this is when they're trying to get loans for next year, and if you've got a bunch of soybeans just sitting in storage bins not selling, it's pretty hard to prove to a bank that you're a viable business.
Exactly. Well, the Trump administration says it now does have commitments from China to keep buying millions of bushels of American soybeans, right? So are the farmers you're talking to selling their soybeans again?
Well, I'm hearing the exporting is starting to resume, but very slowly. You know, as for the trade deals, South Dakota farmers have been telling me they haven't seen anything on paper yet and are just working off promises by the administration. So today I met Kevin Deinert. We climbed up this narrow, slippery staircase to the top of his four-story high grain bin. Let's listen now as he opens the hatch here.
So I sorted everything I could, so it's full. As you can see, a little too full.
Right, so Deinert told me, yeah, exactly. Deinert told me he's been storing as many as he can, holding out for better prices in hopes that President Trump will ink better deals. But here we are almost at the end of the year.
I mean, how much longer can farmers wait at this point?
That's a great question. A lot of farmers I've been talking to throughout this year were already right on the margins. You know, they're still recovering from supply chain problems from the pandemic. You mentioned inflation, tariffs on fertilizer from Canada, to name a few things. You know, Deinert is 38. He's a fifth-generation farmer. He doesn't like the idea of another bailout, he told me today. He just wants to farm and make a living.
And, you know, as farmers, we want trade, not aid. It's meaningful. I'm not going to say it's not meaningful, but is the quantity going to alleviate all the farmers' concerns? I don't think so.
But, Kirk, is this aid package enough to keep farmers on board with President Trump, you think?
Well, this is a question that everybody's been asking, and I've been wondering for months now, talking to farmers and traveling around the country. Farmers are always reluctant to talk politics, but, you know, next year is the midterms. Yep. I'm talking to you from South Dakota. Mm. It's the home state of Senate Majority Leader John Thune. So there's a lot riding on whether these agreements, particularly with China, are going to hold.
Right.
You know, even if they do, farmers say it would really only bring us back to where the export market was a few years ago. And so I think a big question right now is, what was the point of all of this? But if Republicans mm-hmm. want to maintain their majority, they're going to have to need farm country to stay on board.
That is NPR's Kirk Sigler. Thank you, Kirk.
You're welcome.
It's December, the time of the year where we think and talk and hear about nutcrackers more than any other time on the calendar. But the word nutcracker exists beyond the toy soldiers made famous in the holiday ballet. They've been used for centuries to, well, crack nuts. And the largest display of these devices in the U.S. is housed in a museum in Washington State. NPR's Vanessa Romo takes us inside.
Tucked into the Bavarian-esque town of Leavenworth, Washington, is a two-story jewel of whimsy and obsession. It's the Leavenworth Nutcracker Museum, which houses more than 9,000 handcrafted nutcrackers. And presiding over it all is
Arlene Wagner, and I am the curator of the museum, and I'm called the Nutcracker Lady.
Wagner is 4 feet 10 inches tall. She's got a halo of white hair. She wears her signature pearl necklace over a blue German dirndl dress. And yesterday, she celebrated her 101st birthday. She's an enthusiastic font of information on all things nutcrackers.
Nutcrackers are important because the nuts ripen in the fall. And so fall is when grandma starts making pies for Christmas. And they need nuts shelled.
She's eager to show me around.
Come on over here and we'll start here.
Inside, the museum is lined with floor-to-ceiling display cases, from 6 feet tall to mere inches, new and old. There are nutcrackers from 50 countries spanning centuries.
Well, first of all, there are several different kinds of nutcrackers. There's the lever, which has two handles, which can open the nut. There's the screw, which is done by a screw mechanism.
Wagner began the collection unintentionally in 1976. She was the director of a ballet company in Renton, Washington at the time, and was putting up a production of Pyotr Tchaikovsky's The Nutcracker.
We were looking for the nutcracker for Clara to hold, and we found all of these big mouth, crunchy guys, and so we started collecting them.
What started out as a one-off acquisition snowballed into a legacy, she says. Soon, she began to collect them with her late husband, George Wagner.
We saw some, got introduced to the porcelain ones and the old metal ones. Oh, my goodness. We were so taken.
They devoted all of their free time to finding new items. Wagner jokes that she's never had a real vacation.
I have always said that someday I'm going to go to Europe and I'm going to look at all the museums and things that you're supposed to look at instead of antique shows.
By 1995, they'd amassed a collection of 7,000, which became too unwieldy for any sort of home display, Wagner says. It was time to share it with the world.
That was the whole idea of starting the museum, was to let other people enjoy what we enjoy.
One of her favorites is a simple nutcracker from France made from boxwood. It depicts the bust of a man wearing what looks like a laurel wreath. Below the head is a date.
1554. It's the earliest dated nutcracker in the world.
These days, she works about 4 hours a day, and she's got a new nutcracker lady in training who's been by Wagner's side now for years. And she's still on the hunt for nutcrackers.
I might get a message today from somebody. I never know.
But there is one new item that's come in. A 10-inch hand-carved replica of the nutcracker lady herself. It was made by German artisans and sells for $150 in the gift shop. Cloud of white hair and pearl necklace included. Vanessa Romo, NPR News.
This is NPR News. It's the holidays, and for many people, that means more parties and more occasions for alcoholic drinks. NPR's Maria Godoy reports on how alcohol can hit harder as we get older.
Once upon a time, a drink or two went down the hatch with no problems. Now, it's a recipe for misery. Sound familiar? Dr. Monica Christmas of the University of Chicago Medicine says it's a common lament as people enter middle age.
You are not alone. I am in that age range too, and absolutely it needs to be spread out or it's all going to go straight to my head and I will need to sleep half the day away the next day.
There are physiological explanations for why our ability to tolerate alcohol wanes with age. For one thing, the liver enzymes that break down alcohol become less efficient.
And so that means that our bodies metabolize alcohol a little bit differently. We also lose more muscle as we get older, and that muscle is replaced by fatty tissue.
That's important because muscle stores water, which dilutes alcohol in our blood. Having less muscle mass means alcohol will hang around in our bodies longer, says Johannes Truhl. He's an alcohol and substance abuse researcher at Johns Hopkins.
And so what this means is that the same drink that previously maybe felt just fine now leads to a higher blood alcohol level. You feel the effects for longer.
These changes happen to both men and women as they enter middle age. But for women in perimenopause, Christmas says alcohol can exacerbate the symptoms that come with hormonal fluctuations, like mood swings and irritability.
Alcohol is already, it's known to be a depressant. It can also increase baseline anxiety symptoms. Alcohol can disrupt sleep, too. If you're already experiencing all of those symptoms, it's just that much more compounded.
While worse hangovers might not sound like a good thing, think of it as your body nudging you in the right direction. Geriatrician Ken Concilia with the Cleveland Clinic says the risks of drinking alcohol increase with age.
Things like liver disease, increased risk of diabetes, high blood pressure very much can be exacerbated. Memory problems, alcohol use can cause dementia.
It can also interfere with many medications and lead to balance problems and more falls. And drinking alcohol raises the risk of several types of cancer. Concilia says he makes it a point to discuss the benefits of cutting back with his patients.
And these conversations about alcohol use, being proactive with people in their 50s and 60s, has huge impact for their health and well-being when they're in their 80s and 90s.
Johannes Truhl of Johns Hopkins says, well, the healthiest option is to not drink at all. Even small changes to cut back can reap health benefits. During holiday parties, he says, try alternating alcoholic drinks with mocktails and drink plenty of water.
Why don't you just give it a try and see how it feels? Because you might be surprised how good it actually is when you sleep better, you have less anxiety the next day.
He says your body will thank you. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The KQED News Quiz is coming up next, and then stay tuned for political breakdown. But first, let's get your traffic update, starting this time in Mountain View. Here's Julie Deppish.
We're in southbound 101 before Shoreline. Three vehicles tangled up. They're blocking the carpool lane and then the two left lanes. It's pretty backed up to Oregon Expressway. Another three vehicle wreck in San Jose and South 880 after the 101 interchange. It's been blocking the left lane to crawl back to Great Mall Parkway. And we've got a stall in Milpitas on North 880 after Dixon Landing Road taking up the middle lane. You're on the brakes at Calaveras. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Glime, the jeweler. Support for KQED comes from San Francisco Ballet, presenting the holiday tradition Nutcracker. Listeners can experience the captivating music, magical performances, and an onstage blizzard. Runs now to December 28th. Tickets at sfballet.org. And from visitorscoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at visitorscoverage.com. Okay, it's now time for the KQED News Quiz question of the day. Today's question is, Today's Here and Now highlighted skyrocketing health care costs and how this has affected what city. Submit your answers at kqed.org/radio news quiz for a chance to enter to win.
Hamas says it's willing to lay down its weapons after 2 years of war in Gaza, but under what conditions? That story on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition airs from 2 until 9 here on KQED News. And later this week on Forum, the KQED Arts team talks about the best local music of the year, hip-hop, punk, salsa, spiritual jazz, and rock. That's later this week on Forum.
From KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. The Trump administration has threatened to crack down on street homelessness by directing funding away from permanent supportive housing toward short-term programs with work and employment requirements. But now, lawsuits filed by cities, states, and nonprofit organizations seem to be giving the administration second thoughts. On today's Political Breakdown, host Scott Schaefer is joined by Aaron Baldessari, KQED's senior editor of Housing Affordability, to discuss the stakes.
There have been for many years these sort of competing models of how to deal with homelessness. There's the housing first model and the treatment first model. So first of all, maybe walk us through what the difference is between those two approaches.
Yeah. So housing first is this very basic idea that the way to solve homelessness is with a home. It was first studied in New York in the early 90s, where chronically homeless people were placed in scattered site apartments with, as you said, no requirements to get sober or engage in services, although services are typically offered. And they found that it really helped people engage with substance abuse treatment, with mental health treatment, and stay housed. So the model spread, and it caught the eye of the Bush administration, which actually put this into federal policy in the 2000s. And it's been credited with reducing veteran homelessness by 55% since 2010, while overall homelessness has increased by 20%. So,
And veterans are like one of the main sort of targets of this, the beneficiaries of this approach.
Yeah. And, you know, billions have been spent, but homelessness has continued to rise. And I think that's why we're seeing a lot of the criticism and backlash against this model. You mentioned the treatment first approach, and that was kind of the lay of the land before housing first became the dominant strategy. And in that model, housing is sort of treated as a reward for engaging in services. So there are requirements to be sober, there are requirements to get employment, and once you can complete these steps, you might graduate into a transitional shelter and then into permanent housing.
So the Trump administration is essentially proposing to go back to the way it was before the Continuum of Care Act. Is that like completely, or will there still be some money for, you know, this kind of housing first approach?
Yeah. So under the changes that are proposed, the recurring funding that went to support existing housing, most of that money will now be competitive. So it used to be that 90% of the funding was given to projects that were kind of already existing, that were continuing projects. Now it's going to be 30%. So 70% of the money is competitive. And this is a little bit confusing, but it's sort of a separate idea. Of the total money, only 30% can go to permanent housing.
Hmm. And what's the thinking? Is it that, you know, that these policies of housing first haven't worked?
Yeah, the basis is that HUD has called this a slush fund. They say that there are too many people who are living in encampments on the streets. They want to see more encampments getting cleaned up and cleared. They want to see more law enforcement getting involved in clearing those encampments. And they want to see more money going into services for things like sober housing, for institutionalization of people with severe mental illness. And, you know, the idea is that there hasn't been enough focus on the services side, and they really want to emphasize that.
But if you're living on the streets, you know, how do you even like keep an appointment, you know, or to get, you know, treatment for something, you know, or go to a program? I mean, if you're on the streets, your life is very disorganized, right?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's the big criticism of the treatment first model, and part of the reason why housing first became the strategy, because it is. I mean, you're right. It's so much harder to make an appointment, to have your phone charged, to just schedule your life.
Things we take for granted if we have a home.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're constantly thinking about where you're going to be next, having to move from place to place because you can't stay in one place for more than one night, you know, all of that is made so much more difficult when you don't have housing. And that is really the whole idea behind Housing First, that housing should be the foundation for your recovery from substance abuse, for assistance in getting mental health treatment, that you need a stable place to come home to in order to improve these other aspects of your life.
So if these changes go forward, how big a hit would California take? How would we feel it?
I don't have numbers for California as a whole, but in 2023, Bay Area counties received $190 million of this continuum of care funding. And sources that I talked to, you know, are expecting that there's about $100 million on the line in the Bay Area, which is right now housing about 6,800 people. Nationwide, you know, organizations are saying it's about 170,000 people whose housing could be lost if this funding is changed the way that HUD initially proposed to change it.
You know, I know that California has filed a lawsuit, Attorney General Rob Bonta, along with, I think, 19 other attorneys general and a couple of governors. First of all, what's the basis for their lawsuit?
Yeah, so there was that lawsuit, and then there was a second lawsuit. Santa Clara County and San Francisco County, along with other local governments and nonprofits, also filed the lawsuit. And basically, you know, behind both of these, there's this idea that, one, some of the changes being proposed are illegal in some cases. So part of what happened with the proposed changes is that HUD said, look, if you, in the past, recognize transgender people, for example, or in the past used harm reduction policies, we can actually, you know, reduce some of the points that your application is getting. And as I said before, you know, a lot of this is competitive funding, so that is potentially very harmful to California. And they're also saying that the process of these changes, the way that the administration issued these changes, was also illegal. It was against the statute because the statute requires, you know, big policy changes like this to happen in the spring so that these organizations, the entities that rely on this funding, can get a little bit of heads up before they submit their funding application. And so the administration had blown past that deadline. They say they, you know, didn't follow the right process. And that was a big part of those two lawsuits.
So those lawsuits are, you know, going through the courts right now. And it does seem just yesterday that the administration backed off of the cuts and the changes that you've been talking about. Any sense of what that means? Are they giving up on it altogether? Or are they going to kind of rework it?
That is the $100 million question, so to speak. It is very unclear to me and to folks that I've spoken to. So HUD has said that it will release new guidelines before the deadline in January that they had given local governments and nonprofits to file by. But, you know, there are a couple other outcomes that could happen. For instance, the judge could order HUD to issue awards because, unlike previous years, this was actually a 2-year process. And so they could order that the funding that organizations had already applied for last year is maintained. And Congress could also write it into their appropriations bill, which is expected to go before the houses in coming weeks.
That was KQED's Aaron Baldessari and Scott Schaefer. You can hear the rest of their conversation on the Political Breakdown podcast. I'm Natalia Navarro, KQED News.
Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZQuil.com. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR, and from the listeners of KQED. Venezuelan journalist offers a glimpse of what life is like in his country despite the looming threat of war when we return to All Things Considered. KQED News with Natalia Navarro is coming up in 2 minutes. Right now, let's get your traffic update starting in Danville. Here's Julie Depesch.
A bunch of vehicles involved in this wreck heading northbound 680 before a Sycamore Valley Road. They'll be in the second lane for the left, so that's backing up to Crow Canyon Road. Back to the crash in Mountain View, three vehicles south 101 before Shoreline. It's the carpool lane and the two left lanes blocked. Heavy delay back to Oregon Expressway. Trying to clear the stall, Milpitas, north 880 after Dixon Landing Road. Middle lane blocked. You're slow from 237. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more.